This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Okay, thanks everybody for coming. Thanks for coming to my performance, as it were. So happy to be here to talk about some of my recent research in mobile security. So let's get started. So I'm going to start with something that I think everybody is moderately familiar with, especially most of you that I see in the audience, right? So the idea that today our mobile devices, particularly our smartphones, have become essentially an extension of who we are. In many cases, they become the most visible part of who we are, right? So if I meet someone new, one of the first things that we do after we go home is maybe you check out that person's online profile via either Facebook friending them or Snapchat for this next generation and lots of other sort of online presence tools. And then if you look at other types of interactions that we have with the external world, we take our smartphones and they become our mobile wallets, right? And I think with Venmo and a lot of these other electronic and digital wallets, people are finding less and less of a need for actual physical cash, right? And then if you look at things like going to places where you need to be identified, a boarding pass in an airport, even when I'm away from home, I can actually use an app to sort of monitor my house and see what's going on, right? So, and of course, I can't forget what I think most of you are probably busy doing right now, despite the fact that you're all here. Yes, thanks. So I don't know. I've never actually downloaded the app, so I have no idea how many Pokemon are in the audience right now. But you guys can tell me later. But the point here I'm trying to make is that the smartphone really is sort of a piece of us that is the most identifiable to many people digitally and online. And so you can think of this as, me plus my smartphone translates into some little digital avatar, some online version of myself. So what's interesting about this is that if you... A little bit too fast. So what's interesting about this is that if you sort of think a little bit more clearly about what this means, is that a lot of us actually spend more time interacting in a virtual world than we do interacting in the physical world, right? So you sit down, you're on your smartphones, and really what that means is as you're playing with your smartphone, you're actually going through the network and on some host a server out there in, some place where there's some anonymous data center with lots of power and electricity, there's a digital version of you playing alongside other people interacting, doing whatever, okay? And so this is sort of the norm, right? And the more interesting part that I want to talk about today is not so much the societal impact and the impact on a lot of different fields like psychology and human health and all those things. Fascinating questions in many of those fields. But what I want to talk about today is when this particular mapping, this mapping between us, our physical selves, and our virtual selves breaks down. And then what happens as a result of that. All right, so this notion that this sort of transformation back and forth is not always complete. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Well, let's take, for example, a more specific app. Let's take Uber, right? So I think you guys are all familiar with Uber, terrific app, completely sort of, societal changing. It's, serving millions and millions of users around the world, and it's great. So, but if you think about from Uber's perspective, what they see, right? So you're Uber, you're sitting on some ginormous data center somewhere in Europe or in North America, and all you see is not a bunch of drivers driving around and taking people on rides, but what you see is a bunch of data coming in through a network that's somehow going through your switches and your routers, and most of that traffic just looks like it's coming from your smartphone app, right? The large majority of their app, the large majority of their data traffic is just smartphone traffic, right? So the question is, how can you go from that level of traffic back to individuals that are actually using this app in the wild, right? So you hope that when you see an app saying, oh, I'm taking this such and such a passenger on this ride to such and such a destination, that it actually maps to someone, well behaved, some physical driver out in the real world, right? But in fact, this is the assumption that most app developers make, right? And this is a reasonable thing to do. This is sort of the reverse mapping of your virtual world to your sort of physical self. The problem is that this is no longer the case, that this is no longer a foolproof mapping. So what happens now is that in a number of countries around the world today, there are cottage industries where people are now doing things like, as you see this person here, standing in front of a bank of iPads and iPhones, basically manually inputting things to manipulate the smartphone apps into thinking about what they're doing, something that they're not actually doing, right? So in this particular case, what they're doing is they're fooling the Uber app into thinking that they're actually drivers taking some passengers over some prescribed route to gain some fare, okay? And so if you're both the passenger and the driver, then it actually doesn't cost you anything because that money sort of goes right back to you. But in essence, what you can do is you can game the system because Uber has a tremendous amount of monetary incentives that they give to first-time passengers and first-time drivers that you can actually get that money and sort of cheat Uber out of that system, out of that money. Okay, so this is, in fact, a rapidly increasing and growing industry, and this is one of the biggest problems for companies like Uber and Lyft as they sort of expand around the world, where their monetary incentives really become a big deal, right? So $20 can buy you a lot of different things in different parts of the world. So if you go a step further, what happens if we can actually replace these people who are standing there crouching over these banks of iPads with just software, right? So that would be a lot cheaper. You would make more money, and you could probably scale up better, right? So if I can replace this single person with a single tiny script, and I can maybe run 1,000 versions of that at the same time on a laptop, then the amount of money that I could pull in per time is greatly magnified. So clearly that would be of great interest to the attackers. So this is sort of where software comes in, right? So there are scripts now that you can actually fake and completely sort of emulate an actual physical device, where you control all of its inputs, right? So GPS, accelerometers, even fingerprint readings. All those things you can basically generate fake inputs into, all right? And for someone like Uber on the other side, they had no idea what the actual endpoint on the other side of the network is, right? They may think, oh, it looks like my smart app. I'm going to treat it like my smartphone app working with me and do the normal thing, when in fact it's someone else, okay? So where our work comes in is we found a vulnerability or a way, if you will, that this attack can actually be greatly magnified. Okay, so traditionally, I'd say traditionally as in before our work, basically what would happen is a cottage industry would be just like this. You would actually have to have someone physically sitting in front of a iPad or some sort of emulator that doesn't run very fast, and you have to manually press buttons to sort of pretend like how things are. Right? And the reason that is because of this. Right, so this little lock here represents SSL, which is sort of the default encryption method that's used more or less around the web and on all your smartphone apps. Okay, and so it's an encryption method that's quite strong, and it's fairly secure, and it makes sure that the traffic that goes away from your phone en route to the servers is not only unreadable by anyone else, but it's more compact and completely secure. Right, so it identifies the two endpoints. So what we found is that there's actually a very easy way to crack this open and to break the SSL. Not in the sense of sort of completely compromising the system, but in the sense that we can completely eavesdrop on the information. And what that means is that that greatly amplifies the power of a potential attacker because it means that you now know the language that the server speaks to their smartphone app. And you can write a tiny piece of software, a really tiny piece of software, that precisely emulates the smartphone app down to the lowest level of detail and make it superbly, incredibly difficult for the servers to actually detect whether you're a piece of software or their actual smartphone app running on a real device with real GPS and accelerometers and real data coming in. Okay? And so once that happens, then basically you're looking at replacing a single attacker with tiny little scripts, each of which can do exactly what they're doing, but with zero cost because of software, and much, much faster, in a much more controlled way. Right? And so this is sort of the threat that we've uncovered and we've tried to work with companies to try to address. Okay? So let me back up a little bit. Right? So one of the questions that I think people first think of when they hear about this type of work is, well, it can't be that difficult to sort of authenticate a real physical device. And by authenticate, I mean basically distinguish the difference between a piece of hardware that's actually running some software, you know, in the wild and a real user sitting there and pressing buttons versus a piece of software that's completely sitting by itself running autonomously on a server somewhere. Right? So how hard could it be Turns out it's much more difficult than you expect, right? So one of the things that you can imagine, you probably can't read that text or most of it, is the first thing we do is we do things like email verification. You say, well, if you want an account on blah, blah, blah service, send us your email address. We'll send you an email. Prove to us that you own the email by clicking on some link, and then come back to us, and we'll know that, in fact, you're a real person using that email address. Okay? The problem is that nowadays there's very easy ways to generate not only free anonymous email addresses, but generate them in mass in a way that's very, very quickly. Right? So you can generate thousands of email accounts in a fairly short amount of time. Okay? So that doesn't really work. Another thing that we can do, and this is much more intrusive, right? So this is the CAPTCHA system. And you guys have seen this when you browse a web and you go to a certain site and they say, are you a real human being? Prove it to us by typing in the real versions of these squiggly little letters. Okay, and that sort of works, but it's not great on a smartphone because, one, it's really difficult, and if you're outside waiting for a Uber ride, you don't want to be squinting your eyes in the sunlight trying to distinguish some squiggly little letter so you can type it in. But unfortunately, this doesn't even work because today there are entire industries out there called CAPTCHA farms that basically where lots of people sit there in front of a bank of computers, and all they do is they wait for CAPTCHAs to come to them and they solve it for you. Okay, and then they send it back over the internet and online in a very, very fast way. And so sending a CAPTCHA automatically to one of these markets and then getting a response back takes on the order of a couple of seconds. Okay, so extremely fast response times. And as this ad will happily tell you, it's extremely cheap. So solving a CAPTCHA costs roughly about a tenth of a penny in US dollars. Okay, so you can imagine the amount of CAPTCHAs you can solve before you really have to pony up any real cash. So neither of these things work, and then we can sort of get really serious, and we can say, well, what if we really sort of get invasive, right? And what else can we do? Well, we can ask for your phone number and say, okay, if I have your phone number, then I can send you a text, and this is what banks do, this is what Venmo does, right? Give us your phone number, we'll send you some numerical code, type that in on your app, and then we'll verify that that's a legitimate person. Okay? Turns out that's not great either, because now there are completely automated sort of SMS, temporary SMS phone number generators out there, which are basically software systems on the SMS network that will allow you to buy a phone number for a short amount of time, receive some verification code, let's say, and then throw it away after. Okay? So again, completely circumventable. And then finally, if you sort of go to the nuclear option and really say, if I want to absolutely identify that single device, right, then you can think about maybe going after the IMEI number. And the IMEI number is this numerical number that's unique per device. And if you open up the back of your phone or open up the battery case, you'll see it. And in some cases, in all cases, I think, on your iPhone retail box, you'll see it in tiny little print in that little barcode number, right? And so this is a unique number that can be eventually tracked back to your phone, right? So it's unique across the world for all carriers and providers and networks. And the problem is, even this doesn't quite work. So we thought this might be sort of the nail in the coffin to solve the problem, but as it turns out, we looked a little bit harder, and now there's actually software to generate fake IMEI numbers. Right, so the attackers are really, really good. They spend a lot of time sort of gaming the system and trying to patch every single hole that they can see. Right, so in terms of IMEI numbers, there's a database out there that's shared between providers that says these numbers are active and in use. And this is how you check for the validity in the format of a valid IMEI number. Problem is, there is a pattern to it, and that pattern leaked out, and so now there's software that will tell you how to generate a realistic-looking IMEI number, and possibly, if you're lucky, you might get even a real IMEI number that belongs to someone else. Okay, so that doesn't work either. Right? So the end sort of lesson from all this is that there is no fundamental sound way or foolproof way of actually distinguishing on the network something that's been generated by a real human being on a mobile device versus a piece of software, okay? So this is sort of the context that we have, right? And this is sort of the problem. So the next question is, so now what, right? What happens if you have this power? And I'll tell you about how to sort of break in and eavesdrop on the communication in a second, but what happens if you do, right? What happens if you have that power to emulate thousands of devices using a little bit of software? turns out you can do a lot of things, much more than you can sort of imagine, right? So imagine anything that has a social component or a crowd component, right? Anything that has user input, now you can sort of control, right? So if you have, let's say, ratings on a restaurant, well, now I can control that. If you have Foursquare or Pokemon, so I was just telling one of my students, he was like, oh, I'm going to go with a group of friends and we're going to go hang out and catch some Pokemon. And I said, well, you know, we could just do it with software, right? And in fact, I can probably whip up a little script, or he can whip up a little script that will, you know, grab all the Pokemon within some square mile radius, within buildings, you know, on top of roofs, underground, whatever. We can do that. And he's like, no, but it's not the real thing. But the point is that anything that, a smartphone device can do, we can now do with software. Okay? And we can do it in mass. So there's a lot of things that really become possible if you control 1,000 devices at the same time, and they're all under your control. All right, so let's look at some examples. So there's a lot of implications on existing apps. The old one that's really sort of easy to understand is Facebook likes. Right, so this is fake accounts 101. So on Facebook, there's millions of fake accounts. And a lot of these accounts are used to generate likes for pages. It's like clicking on ads. And you can actually sell likes. These are called like farms. You can sell likes for a fair bit of cash. Right? So this is a cottage industry that's been around for a little bit, even before this work. Right? But if you imagine some of the other popular apps, like Yik Yak, like Yelp, so you know, Yelp has a security measure where they say, well, we're going to authenticate a review only when a smartphone device has physically checked in at that location, proving that the person who wrote the review actually ate at that restaurant or went to that music performance or stayed at that hotel or whatever. Right, but that's not a problem for these kind of things. So we can write a little software and that says, oh, you went to that amazing French restaurant across the street and you think the food was absolutely horrid and you found a dead rat in your lasagna. And so, you know, that will destroy a business, right? At the same time, you can do the opposite thing where you, you know, play up, give 5-star rating to some little hole in the wall that really isn't that great. So you can manipulate and control content in all these kind of systems, right? All these systems in general, they will rely on consensus or voting to figure out what the truth is, right? So as I'll talk about in a second, on the Waze navigation system, the way that they find out if someone is lying or is not quite telling the truth about a traffic accident is they just wait for other drivers to drive by. And they say, oh, did you see that car accident that was just reported? If not, then click here. Right? But it turns out, you know, that doesn't quite work when I have 1,000 cars under my control and I can drive them all by the same location. I can say, yeah, I saw that accident. Right? And now I have a little army that votes however I want, whatever I want, whenever I want. Okay? And so it's a lot of power for any one attacker to have. All right, similarly on Yik Yak, I think some of you are familiar with Yik Yak's anonymous social network. You can say whatever you want. There is a voting system that will sort of make content disappear if it goes above, or sorry, below -5 in score, right? So imagine, if you will, that if a single person had this army of Yik Yak content curators, as it were, right? They could basically go to a campus and say, oh, I don't like that. Anything that mentions UCSB in a negative light, I'm just going to vote out of existence because I now have 1,000 voters at my disposal, and bam, it's gone. Before anyone else has a chance to see it, right? So those are the kind of things that you can do, okay? All right, so today I'm going to talk about a couple of things. I already gave you sort of the context for the security problems that exist and some of the challenges that we're all facing. I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of how we got here. We're going to talk about specifically how this attack works in the case of Waze. And Waze is a very popular social navigation system. I'll give you guys examples for what kind of things you can do. And then at the end, I won't have time to talk about our defense. We have a cool little defense that uses sort of peer-to-peer Wi-Fi connections to actually prove that you're in physical locality or proximity with someone else's phone. And then we have an algorithmic way of actually narrowing down physical locality, and you can prove when phones are actually software. But aside from that, I'm naturally not going to have time to talk about that. What I will talk about is a little bit of story, a little bit of history about what we went through to get ways to sort of change our system, right? And this is sort of cute because we had to go to all sorts of lengths to interact with Waze and finally got them to give us their attention and then to actually fix a lot of things that they were not focusing on in terms of security. Okay. All right. So let me get started. So one of the things that's interesting about Waze is that it's very different from the typical map services, right? So in terms of Google Maps and Apple Maps, you see, you sort of know how it works. You type in an address, it says, oh, you're going to go over here, this is where you turn right, this is where you get off the freeway, et cetera. Okay, so Waze is different because it allows you to actually input interesting things. So as you're driving by, you can say, oh, there is a car, or there's a police car hiding in that little hidden spot. You know, there's a speed trap waiting for the next guy to go by. All right, so you can report things like that. You can say, oh, the traffic jam that we're in right now is caused by an accident on the other side of the road, so watch out, that kind of stuff. So it's really tremendously useful because of that, right? So these are all the events that you can actually report. And then on the, as a kicker, you can actually see other users who are nearby, right? And so they do this so that you feel sort of responsible. There's a social component. This is incentive for you to actually go ahead and report things and contribute to the overall system because you're helping other people on the road who are close by. All right, so this is all nice, and it's great. So ever since, I think, 2013, they had something like 50 million users. They were bought by Google, and now all their content goes to Google. And if you use Google Maps, and if you ever see a sort of car accident sign, that's actually coming from Waze, right? So presumably, they have a lot more users right now. I think there's a report that I saw that said, as of 2015, one out of every four drivers in LA was using Waze. So it's a lot of people. All right, so let me run through sort of how we can actually gain access to Waze and how to emulate Waze devices, right? So the key is really simple. So you have basically a Waze client, so let's say a smartphone running the actual software. There's the Waze servers somewhere else, okay? And what we do is we insert our own machine in the middle, and we can convince the smartphone to actually trust our own machine in the middle as if it was the actual Waze server. Right? And the reason we can do that is because we control both the middle box in the middle, the attacker box, and the smartphone client. So SSL and security mechanisms like it were never designed to do that. They were never designed to help protect the smartphone against itself. Right? That just doesn't make sense. So if I have a smartphone working with me, then it's fairly easy to crack the system. So it turns out, I won't go into the details, but what we can do is we can have the Waze client on the smartphone import what's called a public key certificate from our machine and trust it as if it was coming from the actual Waze server. So once you do that, then that means that all the traffic Waze wants to send to the server, it's actually going to send to our machine. And then our machine is going to relay it to the actual server and then take the responses and relay it back to the phone. So in doing so, basically what we have is we have a sort of a eavesdropping channel, if you will, to listen in on the entire conversation between the smartphone and the back-end server, right? So once you do that, then it's fairly easy. Then you can look at the traffic and say, oh, this is what they say when the smartphone wants this information, okay? And then you learn the little language. It's called an API, and it's fairly simple for most smartphone apps. And once you learn the API, then you can basically write a little script that pretends to be a fully featured Waze app running on an actual running smartphone, okay? So that's how we do it. And at the end of the process, turns out we can actually generate something like 10,000 scripts that all run on a single laptop and looks to the Waze server as if it were 10,000 drivers running Waze. Okay? It's a lot of power. So what can you do? Well, the simple things, of course, you can inject all sorts of fake events. You can say, oh, there's a police car over there. You can say, there's a car accident over here. You can slow down traffic because you can have a bunch of your cars go by, but you control the GPS data so it looks like they're really moving super slowly. Okay, and Waze will say, oh, it looks like traffic congestion on 101, whatever. And it'll actually route other people around it, if you like. Okay, so you can do all those things. But that's not sort of the worst of it, right? So we've done examples where we run real experiments and you actually see Waze route other people around a certain region that we've marked off. Okay? What's much more scary is what you can do with user tracking, right? Because of the fact that you can actually see people around you, a potential attacker can actually use this feature to basically scan for people. So let's say you broke up with your significant other and you want to know where he or she is going at all hours of the day, right? So you can put a little tracker on their phone, and what that means is you're not actually tracking physically their phone. You just want to know, let's say, he or she is getting out of work at 5 o'clock at a particular location. You watch for their device, and then you basically have your own little device follow them. And then wherever they go, your little virtual device reports the ways that you're just right behind that particular car, right? And then you'll basically get a running feed of exactly where they are, down to the GPS level, right? So you know exactly where they are, so down to the exact store or parking lot or whatever it may be, all right? You can do so while staying visible because you can. There's a little trick where you can actually jump in and out of range so that they will never have a chance to see you while you're following them, which is really creepy. Right? You can actually track them even when they're not using Waze. This is really bad. So Waze, for a long time, basically reported GPS values all the time, even if you're asleep in your bed. And the Waze application could be, you know, in the background on your phone, but it's still reporting data. And then finally, you know, even when you go to bed and then wake up and turn off your phone and turn back on, we can still, the hackers can still potentially track you because they know exact location and there's only one Waze user at that particular location. All right? So time constraints, I'm going to sort of, this is a little running demo, but basically we've run experiments where we track our own students and it works really, really well. So it works in normal environments like this. This is, you know, someone taking a drive from UCSB to downtown Santa Barbara, but also works in highly congested areas or really high-speed environments. So 101, LA downtown area, that all works, right? Even when there's huge crowds, lots and lots of cars in the row, you can exactly follow one person. So I want to probably finish up by telling you a little bit about sort of what we went through after this. So we started this work in roughly about late 2014, and we realized how bad it could get. And so before we even did a lot of experiments and wrote up a paper, I contacted a bunch of my friends at Google, particularly Google Security, to try to get to the Waze people to modify their system, at least give them a heads up on what we're about to sort of publish and discover. And it was really difficult, because Waze, for all intents and purposes, is still in Israel. So they're sort of partitioned off from the rest of Google. So for a long time, nothing happened, despite our messages through my Google friends at the Google security team. And then sometime a little bit later, they did an upgrade where they started to not report GPS locations when your Waze was not running, when it was in the background, which was a big plus, but still, not a lot after that. So finally, in about May or April of this year, our paper was about to come out, and I couldn't stall anymore, so I contacted some media people. Fusion, Cashmere Hill at Fusion, she used to be at Forbes, and they write exclusively a lot about sort of privacy issues and technology. So her article really got a lot of people's attention. It caught a lot of press from everywhere, from here to UK to Israeli TV to TV station Tampa, Florida, all sorts of random places. And then finally, we got Waze's attention, right? So immediately the next day, they came out with a PR release saying, oh, no, it's not really as bad as people think. And it turns out it actually is. Oops, my clicker. So the end story of all this is that we went through so many iterations of sort of going back and forth with Waze. You're not expected to actually read all that. That's just there to show you the timeline. But we went through a lot of back and forth with Waze to actually force them to fix our system. And at the end of the day, I won't bore you with the details. We can talk about that in Q&A. But at the end of the day, the attack still exists, but it's a lot harder to perform. They've gotten a lot more careful with how they spread the GPS data and who reports the GPS data. And I will skip through this slide because of time, but basically, this attack still actually works on a lot of other apps. So whether it's Whisper or Tinder or Lyft or still Uber, you can actually pretend to be mobile devices using software and do a lot of damage as a result. Okay, so let's get to the Q&A, and I'll stop up there with the talk. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.